October 2nd, 2012, in Vrindavan, the Vaichi, Canto 1, Chapter 8, Text 45 to 52. Let's read through the verses. Thus accepting the prayers of Srimati Kunti Devi, the Lord subsequently informed other ladies of his departure by entering the palace of Hastinapur. But upon preparing to leave, he was stopped by King Yudhisthira, who implored him lovingly. So it's just interesting that none of the ladies could stop him, but Yudhisthira could stop him. Of course, one of the main reasons that Yudhisthira could stop him is that Krishna wanted to go to Bhishma and so forth and so on. King Yudhisthira, who was much aggrieved, could not be convinced despite instructions by great sages headed by Vyasa and Lord Krishna himself, the performer of superhuman feats, and despite all historical evidence. King Yudhisthira, son of Dharma, overwhelmed by the death of his friends, was aggrieved just like a common materialistic man. O sages, thus deluded by affection, he began to speak. King Yudhisthira said, O my Lord, I am the most sinful man. Just see my heart, which is full of ignorance. This body, which is ultimately meant for others, has killed many, many phalanxes of men. I have killed many boys, brahmanas, well-wishers, friends, parents, preceptors, and brothers. Though I live millions of years, I will not be relieved from the hell that awaits me for all these sins. There is no sin for a king who kills for the right cause, who is engaged in maintaining his citizens, but this injunction is not applicable to me. I have killed many friends of women, and I have thus caused enmity to such an extent that it is not possible to undo it by material welfare work. As it is not possible to filter muddy water through mud or purify a wine-stained pot with wine, it is not possible to counteract the killing of men by sacrificing animals. So we're just going to go over this briefly. So Prabhupada makes the point that Maharaj Yudhisthira is inconsolable by the will of Krishna, who desires Yudhisthira to hear from Bhishma, and is compared to? The bewilderment of Yudhisthira is compared to?
Arjuna.
Arjuna, bewilderment of Arjuna. So when we're bewildered, how do we know if we're just bewildered or if it's Krishna bewildering us? You assume that it's just Maya. That's your default value. It must be Maya because I'm not Yudhisthira or Arjuna. How else would you know whether you're just bewildered by Mahamaya or by Yogamaya? How would you know if it's Krishna's will? Yes?
Maybe if it's the same like Guru Shastra and Sattva say.
What do you mean? Give me an example.
Everything is related. Does not oppose Guru Shastra and Shastra.
It doesn't oppose Guru Shastra and Shastra, but Arjuna's bewilderment was opposed to Guru Shastra and Shastra, and Yudhisthira's bewilderment is opposed to Guru Shastra and Shastra. Sorry. Good try.
I think everything is under the will of Krishna, even you are in Maya, but it depends how much devotee you are, because then you are, the more devoted Krishna you are, the more it's under the will of Krishna straight.
Okay, so everything's Krishna's will, but the more you're a devotee. By the way, your Guru Sadhu Shastra answer is a very good one, but not in regard to your bewilderment, in regard to what? This Bhishma will say this later. Yes.
If
isn't that funny? Mitasmit Yogyanam Apoha Pohanam Cha.
One comes out of that equivalent and then you need to take shelter of Purusha Shastra.
Yes, but how do you know if your bewilderment itself is part of Krishna's plan for his service? Or just like when Srila Prabhupada purchased the land in Mumbai at Juhu Beach. He purchased it from this Mr. Nair, who was a thief. And Prabhupada said, Krishna did not let me know that Mr. Nair was a thief, because then I wouldn't have bought the land. So Prabhupada was saying that Krishna had bewildered him. So when we get bewildered, how do we know if we don't know? Okay. You just say we don't know.
If we have done everything our best and we are still in the predicament, we could understand this anxious arrangement.
Yeah, that's a nice answer. And when we say everything our best, I understand that to mean if I'm strictly following Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, not that my bewilderment that is, but if my life is under Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So Bhishma says this later. He said, you're protected by God, Dharma, and the Brahmanas. Therefore, everything that happens to you must be the will of Krishna. So if your life is strictly under Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, then you can assume that Krishna is involved in your life, even sometimes with our bewilderment. Alright, and then there's a point here that Srila Prabhupada talks about quite a bit in various places.
What is the right answer to your question?
I don't know if there's one right answer. I think in general one could say that if my life is according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, I really like this answer, you know, that whatever, depending on my degree of surrender, to that degree Krishna is pulling the strings in my life.
But in the case he's Arjuna, against
his bewilderment was, but his life in general was following Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra.
In general.
I say the same thing, you know, Srila Prabhupada was in general, he's following Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So if he ends up buying land from a cheater, then we can say Krishna was involved with that. That's also a kind of bewilderment, not to understand the real situation. We see that that Krishna sometimes, Krishna has different ways of getting people to do what he wants them to do. Maharaj Purkit is another example. Where Prabhupada keeps saying in those purports, every purport, it was Krishna's will, it was Krishna's will, it was Krishna's will, it was Krishna's will, that Maharaj Purkit felt hungry and thirsty, that Maharaj Purkit got angry. You know, that Maharaj Purkit wasn't generally the kind of person who would get angry just because he was hungry and thirsty. I mean, if I'm hungry and thirsty and tired, I get angry. Don't you all get grouchy when you're hungry, thirsty, and tired? But Purkit doesn't get grouchy just because he's... You understand grouchy? So if Maharaj Purkit gets grouchy when he's hungry, thirsty, and tired, it must be the will of God. Because it's not his general demeanor. That's a hard thing to say. I mean, in general, it's a pretty safe bet to say that my bewilderment is my own foolishness. And Krishna may even use my foolishness for some higher purpose. Krishna can use my everything for a higher purpose. If I'm trying to be a devotee, he can even use my bewilderment for a higher purpose. Think about the story of Maharaj Anga, where he married a woman who wasn't worthy of him, and therefore he had this bad son, Vena. And Prabhupada writes in the purport that in the Vedic times, they used to be very, very careful who married whom. But he said sometimes by the will of the Lord, a mistake was made just to facilitate the devotee's detachment. So I'm thinking about a couple of devotees I know who were thinking about getting married, and they came to me and they told me their situation, and I said, I wouldn't get married to each other if I were you. I said, if you were my daughter or my son, I wouldn't advise that you marry each other. If I were in your situation, I wouldn't marry the other one. But I said, you know, it's your life. You've got to decide what you want to do. So They came back after 2 weeks and said, we want to go ahead with the marriage, and it's been rather interesting. So you think, you know, well, somehow Krishna is going to use that. Somehow they were bewildered why they married each other, I don't know. And Krishna is somehow going to use that because they're chanting Hare Krishna and their devotees. He's going to use it for some purpose. There's a really interesting verse 48, where Maharaj Yudhisthira says his body is meant for others. Parakyasya. Para means other. Yasya, his. Dehasya, of the body. My body's meant for others. So Prabhupada speaks about this point quite a lot. Generally, I think my body is meant for me. My body is meant to please me, although it doesn't do a very good job of it. My body's not very pleasing. But Maharaj Yudhisthira can understand that his body was meant for others. His body is meant to serve his parents, or to serve the wife, or to serve your children, or to serve the society. And ultimately, when we die, our body is going to serve some other living entities who will eat it. But yet we put so much effort into the body. And you're saying, how can we do sins just for the sake of the body, which is not even ours? You know, who would do sinful activities to maintain somebody else? To maintain some other family. So that's Maharaj Yudhisthira's view. And it's a very difficult way to think about our body, that my body is actually meant for others. It's not meant for me. The most significant thing I wanted to discuss at the end of this chapter is the web of karma. So in 50, 51, 52, and Srila Prabhupada in 50 says that Maharaj Yudhisthira was fighting for his own self-aggrandizement. Of course he wasn't. He was fighting for Dharma and for Krishna's direction. But he thought like that. I'm fighting just so I can be the king. I'm fighting just for my own reputation and my own power, etc. I'm not fighting as part of my duty. Because after all, I wasn't the king. Duryodhana was the king. So Duryodhana could fight as part of his duty, but how could I fight as part of my duty? So a lot of what entangles us is our motives. In fact, we could say, practically speaking, everything that entangles us is our motives, our consciousness. It's not so much what we do, but it's why we do it. What's our mentality? That's what Krishna is telling Arjuna, change your mentality, change your motives. But often we're not even aware of our motives. We're often not honest with ourselves about our motives. And we can see this in other people. When other people deal with us, and they may say, oh, this is my motive. And we look at them and think, I don't think that's your motive. I think you have another motive. So one reason we get entangled in karma is that we don't see ourselves honestly. We don't understand what's going on in our heart. I believe I mentioned this the other day. I mentioned how when I had a job that people were not, I was talking about humility, that people out in the world, they haven't even the beginning clue that they might be envious or lusty or greedy, or they don't even have a concept of it. I mean, we devotees have it at least as theory. You know, I may actually think, oh, I'm a great devotee and I love Krishna, but at least I'll say, well, really, I'm fallen and I'm envious. But most people in the world, they have not even an idea. But even as devotees, it is so easy to think, oh, I'm doing this service just because of some kind of pure love and pure motive, and I'm really so elevated in my heart. The materialistic person thinks, I sometimes do bad things, but I have a good heart. Whereas the devotee sees, maybe I sometimes do good things, but my heart is all rotten. Actually see the material desires in their heart. I wrote a birthday wish to one devotee and I said, I hope you get the fulfillment of your heart's desires. And he wrote back and said, I certainly hope not. So that's one thing that entangles us in karma that we're very unaware of. is what are we doing things for? What's our motives? What's driving us? Like the Bhagavatam says, the whips that are driving us. And then Maharaj Yudhisthira says in 51, this cannot be undone by material welfare work. So that was seen in the case of King Riga. That King Riga had done one mistake, but all of his pious activities didn't counteract that mistake. You can't counteract sinful activities with pious activities. They're two different accounts. You have your sinful account and your pious account. And we used to have a system like that in the Gurukula. We had plus points and minus points. And you got rewards for the plus points, and you got punishments for the minus points. And they didn't cancel each other out. And that's the way it is in life. You know, the good things I do don't cancel the bad things I do, or vice versa. You know, if you commit a crime, it doesn't matter what a nice person you are, you still committed a crime. It's taken separately. You know, of course, your whole character may be considered in terms of the punishment. But the point is that just being a good person and just being a nice person and doing good works will not erase the sins that we do. And every conditioned soul does sins. You know, when I was walking here, there's a place where there's lots of ants. I'm sure I stepped on some. It'd be impossible not to step on any. Right? You'd have to have a broom like the Jains have. Go everywhere with the broom. So what can you do? And then what about the little bugs I can't see? I mean, those ants are so tiny that when I'm walking, I can't even see them. But to speak of the little tiny bugs and the little tiny germs, and we're driving our car and so many bugs are dying on the windshield. And none of our good work or our pious work will counteract that. It's not enough. And what I found, though, is the most interesting here is in 51 about how karma creates one action. That basically Maharaj Yudhisthira is saying, okay, and this came up in Kunti's prayers too, she said, okay, we've had this battle, we've won, but now the sons and grandsons of the people who died are our enemies. So it's like that in some parts of the world where people have been fighting, two groups of people have been fighting, sometimes for decades or sometimes hundreds of years. And it started because, you know, Mr. A killed Mr. B. And so Mr. A's children want to kill Mr. B's children, and Mr. B's children want to kill Mr. A's children. Then the grandchildren want to kill each other, and the great-grandchildren, and nobody can remember how it started. You know, 500 years ago, A killed B. Who knows what the problem was? And still, they're fighting. So, of course, this is going on in the Middle East. And fighting. You took my land. No, you took my land. Who took whose land? Do you know it was 100 years ago? Or maybe it was 2,000 years ago. And they're still, you know, just get on with life already. But no, you did this, and you did this, and you did this, and like Gandhi said, an eye for an eye, making the whole world blind. So this is the web of karma. So I'm going to make another point now, which again, like the other one I made, if you can get this point, this is worth the whole time that we're spending together, this one point. Don't look for closure in your material activities. Don't look for closure. If you get it, fine. If you don't get it, it doesn't matter. You don't have to settle your relationships with everybody because it never gets settled. You feel satisfied that the situation is settled with something. This goes on life after life after life. And it's one of the big reasons why we take birth again and again. Again. So there was Karna, Kunti's son, by the sun god. And he was abandoned at birth. He was raised by Shudra parents. But he knew he was a Kshatriya, he had a Kshatriya nature. And he was trained as a Kshatriya. And at the graduation ceremony of the Pandavas, he came and exhibited his skills. But the Pandavas were complaining, who is this man? They didn't realize he was their brother. When Kunti saw him, she fainted. And Vidura, noticing that, deduced that he was Kunti's son. She didn't say anything. So Karna couldn't compete. And then Duryodhan came and said, he could see this Karna was the possibility of him defeating Arjuna. So he said, I will make you the king of Anga. Now you're Kshatriya. Now you can compete. So Duryodhan felt, Karna felt, I owe Duryodhan a big debt. And for those of you who aren't English speakers, it's not debt, it's debt. You don't say the B. I owe Duryodhan a big debt. And he never felt he finished paying it. He thought the only way he could pay this debt was either to kill Arjuna or to die trying. He didn't think anything else was sufficient. So at a certain point, Kunti told Karna, you're my son. And then Arjuna told Karna, you're Kunti's son. And Arjuna said to Karna, we will give you the world. You can be the oldest Pandava. And Karna said, yes, Krishna, I know you're God. I know you're going to win. I know the Pandavas will win. I know we're not going to be victorious. I know I should surrender to you, but I have a debt to Duryodhan. Krishna said, forget the debt to Duryodhan. Just come with me. And Karna said, I can't. I have to pay it back. So just like in this life, there's one shopkeeper here. I bought something, and it was 12 rupees, so I didn't have change. Gave him 2 tens. And he gave me back 1 ten. He said, pay me the 2 rupees later. So today I bought something from another shopkeeper and I got back 1 5 and 1 1. So I went to the other shop. I gave him the 1. And I said, I'll pay you the... I still owe you 1 rupee. And he just smiled. I don't think he ever expected me to pay him back the 2 rupees. But we are like that. If I owe somebody money, I remember. Do you do that?
Yes.
If you owe someone money, you remember, and you think about, how can I see them to pay it back? And if somebody owes you money, you also remember, right? Like someone in Mayapur owes me 900 rupees, so I remember. Oh, they owe me 900 rupees. When I go there, I need to ask them. You don't forget. It's like that with karma. If I owe somebody karma, I remember. And I want to pay it back. Please don't think just that someone is forcing us to pay it back. We want to pay it back, like Karna. The Prabhupada says we're forced by the laws of nature. That's because we want to play the game. If you're playing a game, then the umpire will force you to follow the rules. But if you don't want to play a game, no one's going to force you to follow the rules. You ever play the game Monopoly? You know the game Monopoly? So this world is like a Monopoly game. All the money I owe you and all the money you owe me is all fake money. It's not real money. So you can't stay in the game and be a cheater. You can't stay in the game and not pay your bills. But you can quit the game. Aham tvam sarva pavebhyo mokshi shyami manasuchaha. I'll take care of all that, Krishna says. Don't worry. Just quit the game and come with me. But we don't want to do that. We want to, no, but I owe this person, and this person owes me, and I owe this person, and this person owes me. What about all this debt I owe? And then we take birth again and again and again and again and again. Because as soon as it doesn't end. If I pay my karmic debt to this person, and I collect my karmic debt from this person, in the process of doing that, Maharaj Yudhisthira is saying, and Prabhupada is saying, what happens? What happens? You get more. You can't just say, okay, I'm gonna pay everybody the karmic debt I owe them. I'm gonna collect my karmic debts and now I'm free. As soon as you start trying that, and people don't always let you. And not everybody pays you. Right? You have people who've hurt you. Does everyone have someone who's hurt you who has not said, I'm sorry? Do you all have somebody like that in your life? They've hurt you, and they've never said a real I'm sorry. They've never understood. They've never given you closure. They've never given you satisfaction. Correct? Am I correct? And if you're thinking, I need satisfaction, this person has to understand how they've hurt me. We have to settle it. We have to close it. They have to pay me my debt, the debt they owe me. They may not. Then what happens? What will happen? You'll come back to collect your debt. And sometimes people, I owe a debt and they won't take it. And then I think, or they're not satisfied with it. I pay them back and they say it's not enough. Right? Some people, I do things for them and they're not satisfied. It's not enough. And if I'm trying to settle things with them again, I might come back. Oh, this doesn't end. At some point, you have to walk away from the monopoly game. Just finish. Prabhupada talks about this with taking vanaprastha. He says, at 50, you take vanaprastha. Business finished, business not finished. Of course, you know, when Prabhupada took vanaprastha, he was like 54. It's not that your 50th birthday, necessarily. Prabhupada talked about it like a shop. The shop says, we are closed at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock, they close. I remember one time going to a bank 2 minutes before 5. Sorry, we're closed. I said, but there's 2 more minutes? No, we're closed. Maybe the biggest customer is waiting outside. I'm sorry, now we're closed. Correct? When you go to get on an airplane, the gate closes. The door is closed. You may be the best airline customer flying first class. I'm sorry, the gate is closed. So we need to be determined, gate is closed. Whatever karmic debt is there, I don't care anymore. I'm not going to try to collect my karmic debt, nor am I going to try to pay my karmic debt. I'm going to serve Krishna and let Krishna take care of it. Finished. Emotionally, to let go of the desire for closure. It doesn't happen. It's an illusion. That just, oh, if I get a little further, then everything will be good. Everybody will like me, and I'll like everybody, and there won't be any more problems. It doesn't happen, because as soon as you settle one thing, you create something more. That's the point Prabhupada's making here. You have a war, you kill all your enemies, and you create new ones. You cannot finish karma by karma. You cannot finish karma by karma. You cannot finish karma by karma. It never ends. It just doesn't end. If you think, I'm going to wrap up all my material life and close everything and everybody will be happy, and it doesn't happen. So a lot of it is letting go of this desire. I was counseling one girl who was born in the movement. Very, very nice girl. And she was telling me how her mother never connected with her emotionally. That she was very emotionally neglected, and her mother would speak very harshly to her. And so she had a lot of pain from the dealings with her mother. And she told me, I just want my mother to apologize. I just want my mother to understand how I feel. How can I do that? Tell me what to do, she was asking me, to get my mother to apologize. Now, of course, that's always an impossible thing. Tell me what to do to get somebody else to do something. We can always ask, tell me what to do so I can do something. But tell me what to do so I can make someone else do something doesn't work, ever. That's never a good plan. But I said to her, your mother may never apologize. So your whole life may go by, your mother may never understand how she hurt you. She said, well, she has to understand. I said, why? I said, why can't you find a way to be happy even if she doesn't understand? The girl wouldn't accept. Finally, I said to her, maybe this is from a past life. And she got very offended. She said, oh, you mean I've hurt somebody like this? I said, I don't know, maybe. I said, but I think your relationship may be from a past life. I said, maybe in the past life there was some problem between you and this jiva, and now you've taken birth again to settle it, to get closure, to have it finished. I said, in this life again you're trying to have closure, you're trying again to have it settled. Suppose it doesn't get settled in this life. And then she was quiet for a long time, and she said, I don't care anymore if my mother says she's sorry or not. I don't want another life with her to try to settle this. So this is very important. It's very important. Maharaj Yudhisthira is making this point very clearly. He says that you cannot settle material things with material things. Now what Maharaj Yudhisthira is not understanding right now, which we'll understand in a few minutes, is that you can settle it with Krishna consciousness. But that means it's unsettled. It's just like every night we go to sleep. When you go to sleep, do you go to sleep with everything being done you wanted to do that day? Sometimes. I don't know about all of you. My to-do list is usually longer than my time. So generally when I go to bed, there's something I wish I would also have done that day. But do you just not sleep? So at a certain point, you just walk away and say, whatever is done, is done. Don't care anymore. And best to live our lives that we really don't care about closure. Now, we try, obviously, if you owe somebody money, you try to pay them, etc. But, you know, emotional attachment. Yes?
How do you decide at what point you need to walk away?
I think you emotionally walk away from point one. Always, always emotional detachment. Always. And who knows, you may die in the next 2 minutes. If you say, I'm going to be emotionally attached now, and, you know, 10 years from now, I won't be. Always emotional detachment. Yes?
What about the death to the guru? I think so much gratefulness.
Oh, that's love. That's not karma. That's love. That's a different thing.
Can it take you to spiritual?
Yes. That's a different thing. To feel an eternal debt of love to the guru and to the Vaishnavas and to Krishna, that's something else. That's not a scorecard.
Somebody owes me a big amount of money. I don't pursue that because I feel that if I pursue that, it's going to bother me.
Well, you can pursue it, but with detachment.
But if I pursue it, I'm going to be attached. You know, it's a big amount of money, so I'm at least by not pursuing it.
If that works for you. But if you can do things without attachment. I read an interesting story from a lawyer once. I have a copy of it on my computer. True story. Where the man was a beginning lawyer and he was struggling, and certain of his clients didn't pay him. And it was really bothering him. And then he decided, he was a Christian man, and he decided at Christmas, one Christmas, he was going to forgive anyone who owed him money. So he wrote a Christmas card to these people who owed him money and said, you know, I forgive you, it's Christmas, and for Christmas I'm forgiving you your debt, and I ask that you forgive someone else who owes you money. It was very hard for him to do this, by the way, because he was struggling. and he was having to cut firewood to make extra money for his family because people weren't paying him what they owed him. But when he wrote these cards and he put them in the mail, he felt free. And he felt, these people are not supporting me, God is supporting me. And it was very interesting. He said that most of the people he sent cards to never even acknowledged that they got the card. Nothing. Nothing. And most of them never paid the money. Few of them did. He said few of them got, you know, actually paid. And a few of them would write, you know, thank you very much. You know, I've excused other people or something like that. And he started doing this every year. So every Christmas, any bill that was not paid, he would excuse it. And he said instead of getting poor, he actually got richer. And his legal practice flourished. And he felt free. He didn't feel that he was a slave to his clients. And every once in a while, someone he'd sent a card to would come to him, you know, some fraction and in gratitude. So one can forgive in that way. I remember one time I got a birthday present from my parents of $600. And I didn't generally have money that was like mine. You know, all the money I had was for family's money. And then somebody asked to borrow it, and they never returned it. And I was really angry, you know. I was like, that was my money. And I had this plan, and this plan, and this plan, and this plan, these things I were going to buy, and I hardly ever have any money that's just mine, that I can do what I want. And finally I said, this is ridiculous. My relationship with this person and my relationship with Krishna is worth more than $600, and I just let it go and forget about it. So there can be a time that you just say, you know, I'm going to let it go externally also. But certainly we should let things go internally, always. You know, whatever somebody owes me, whatever, you know, and even things that I owe people that they're not willing to, I mean, I make an effort. But whether or not they accept it, that's not in my hands. I can't force somebody to accept. Somebody was trying to do that with me the other day. Some girl was trying to force me to accept her apology. And she's already apologized to me about 500,000 times, and I've already accepted 500,000 times. I just said, don't apologize to me anymore. I'm not angry with you, and just I don't want to hear. But she's still thinking it's not settled, it's not settled, it's not settled, it's not settled, it's not settled. I don't know exactly what she wants. I said, don't tell me you're sorry anymore. I've already told you it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. I'm fine, I'm not angry with you. Don't say you're sorry. And again she came up to me and said, but I'm so sorry. And then she's just making me annoyed all over again, you understand? Why can't this person stop telling me they're sorry? So from her position, the way she's feeling is she owes me something and I'm not accepting it. That's how she's feeling. From my position, I feel like I've already accepted it and I'm fine. She doesn't owe me anything. That's how I'm feeling. But that's not how she's feeling. She thinks she owes me something. And she's very, very, very disturbed. I even had another lady come up to me and say, you know, this girl, she just wants you to tell her that it's okay. I said, I've already written her 10 letters. I said, not writing her another letter. I said, you can write her a letter, whatever you want. But when I'm on that end, sometimes I'm on that end. Sometimes I feel like I need to settle. Do you understand? Everybody understand what I'm talking about? Sometimes I feel like I need the other person to acknowledge. They may not. It's like, you know, it's not just people who owe me, it's people that I owe. This is so important. Please, it's so important. We suffer karmically because we want to. We take birth and we suffer and enjoy because we choose. We are only being forced, like Prabhupada says, we're forced by the stringent laws of nature because we want to play the game. If you're playing football, they will force you to play by the rules, but you have to want to play football. If you don't want to play football, nobody's going to make you follow the rules. Does this make sense to everybody? First, Okay, so first, suppose I'm playing a game with you. Okay? You and I, we're playing a game. I say, I want to play a game with you. And then I'm cheating. You say, you have to follow the rules. But that's because I am choosing to play the game. Or let's say we're having some football game. Well, you know, you and your friends are having a football game and they're not following the rules. And you say, you have to follow the rules. And you will force them to follow the rules. But it's if you want to play, then you must follow the rules. It's like if you want to come to India, you have to follow the visa rules. If you don't want to come to India, you don't have to follow the visa rules. So someone is forcing you to follow the visa rules because you want to come to India. So the laws of nature, Yamaraj, they are forcing us to pay our karmic debts because we want to be in the game. We don't want to be in the game. We're not forced. Is this clear to everybody? Yes?
There's a question. I owe you money. I don't pay you the money. So you don't have to think that, you know, that money would have been used in service of Krishna. So you don't have to be after that money.
As long as I'm not attached and thinking I need personal closure. I can do it out of duty. I can say this is money for Krishna. Yeah, but still Krishna may not give. We had one building contractor who came at night and stole materials from us and then sued our school. We had to fight him in court. And we won, but he never paid. So we actually won in the court. We never collected the money.
Well,
what can I do? I mean, I made an effort as my service. It was Krishna's money that this man stole. I made some effort. But I don't, if I'm thinking personally, then I'll come back again. And same, if I owe somebody, please try to understand this. My karmic suffering is all because I owe a debt. Does that make sense to everybody? What does it mean? Oh, this is my karma. What does that mean? It means I owe a debt. Is that, you all understand?
So it means about, so it means by repaying your debt, you're still not going to get free. You will only get free if you're Krishna conscious, and that's
yes.
Repaying all the debts.
Yes, because then you walk away from the game. Why does it get rid of all the debts? Because they're not real debts. They're play debts. You can walk away from the Monopoly game in the middle of the game. This Monopoly game is always in the middle of the game. The game doesn't end. Nobody wins. It just goes on and on and on and on. Then everyone goes to sleep. They get tired and everyone goes to sleep in Mahavishnu's body. Then they wake up and they start the game again. Like you leave the game board in the room and you all go to bed and you wake up and you play again. And the pieces are in the same place. And it just keeps going on. It doesn't end. And you're thinking, well, I'll pay this debt, I'll do this, and then it will be over. It will never be over. The only way to be over is to walk away from the game. What does it mean Krishna plays your debts? It's a game. It's just play money. It's not real money. Yes?
My question is, now in a particular game, we can put the theory. In a particular game.
Yes.
We can quit the game and quit the field.
Quit the game and quit the field.
But now here in this material world is the field. Quit the game and get the field.
You can be, that's like the lotus leaf. It appears to be in the water, but there's no water touching it. If you become here as Krishna's agent, you're not playing the game anymore. It may look like that to other people. It may look like that. Externally, it may look like that. And actually, Yudhisthira wasn't playing the game. He's there as Krishna's agent, as Krishna's beloved. And for him, there was no sin. There was no debt. There was no entanglement. There was none of this stuff. He was there as Krishna's agent. He wasn't there to play the game. He wasn't an illusion. but he's manifesting illusion so we can get these good instructions. But we want to be like Arjuna and Yudhisthira. We want to be able to work in like Srila Prabhupada. And so many, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur. We want to be able to work in the world. Our philosophy is not that you go sit at Radhakund and chant 500,000 names a day and eat only one carrot and sleep only a half an hour. That wasn't Srila Prabhupada's desire. His desire was that we work hard. We were just reading that yesterday, to work with valor, but depend on the Lord and not be an idle parasite of the Lord. Now, if you're Haridas Thakur, you can just chant all day. But even Haridas Thakur would preach. How he had time for that, I don't know. He would go out with Lord Nityananda to preach. So we should be active, but not active for the Lord. And we can try to, you know, take care of... We should try to be nice people in the world. We don't want to embarrass Krishna. It's not that I want to steal people's money in the world and not pay what I owe people and be a nasty person, and that's not going to make Krishna happy. But I'm not doing it because I'm trying to have a perfect material situation, have things settled in the world. I'm not trying to win this game because you can't win it. It's unwinnable. Can't win it. You can't say, okay, now I've won the game and now I'm going to enjoy it. It just doesn't happen. So anytime that we have some feeling with another jiva, that I've got to settle things with this jiva, I must. I mean, I might have a duty to try in Krishna's service. But if I think I must settle it so I can be peaceful and happy, that is very dangerous. There's this story later in the Bhagavatam, I think in the 9th canto, where this, I can't remember the names, I should look this up and remember the names. There was this one disciple, I believe, of Vasistha, and he wanted his guru to do a yajna. And he said, please, Guru, would you perform the yajna? And Vasistha said, oh, right now I'm serving Indra. When I finish serving Indra, I'll come and do your yajna. And the disciple said, you know, that his guru left. The disciple thought, well, life is very short. By the time Vasistha finishes with Indra, who knows? So he engaged another priest to do the yajna. And when Vasistha came, he was angry. And he said, I curse you to be a Shudra. And then this devotee renounced material life and engaged in bhakti and went back to Godhead. He did not come and take birth as a Shudra. So if you're engaged in bhakti, whatever is there, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. Now, we each have dozens or hundreds of lives of upcoming karmic reactions from what we've done in the past. And there's so many jivas who think that we owe them something, honestly. There's so many jivas that we've offended and we've hurt, isn't it? Am I the only one who offends people? So many people, you know, who think, Urmila owes me something. Do I have to come back a million lifetimes to pay all of that? So Krishna will arrange. I don't have to worry, Nasuchana, I don't have to worry. If Krishna wants me to stay and pay back, okay. If he doesn't, that's fine. That's up to him. But I don't feel myself like Karna. That's what we want, to get rid of the feeling that Karna had. The Karna had this feeling, I cannot surrender to Krishna because I have to pay my debts. I can't close the shop. I've got to do it. I've got to keep chasing and chasing and chasing this person for me to pay that back or for them to pay me back. There are people who will never give us what they owe us. And I'm not just talking about money, but some sort of money is really a symbol of other things. But who will never give us what they owe us and will never accept what we owe them. That will always be. Is this clearer? Okay, this is again one of these things that if you get this in your life, it's a very simple thing, one of these simple things that if you get this in your life, your whole life becomes happier and freer. It's a very small thing, but it has huge effects. Okay? Sarva Dharman Paritya Jamame Kam Sharanam Prajahan Tom Sarva Pape Don't worry about all these dharmas. You know, you may do your dharmas as a service, but you're not doing the dharmas because you want something. You're not doing the dharmas out of a sense of material obligation for you to anybody or anybody to you. You don't have a debt to your parents, to your husband, to your wife, to your children, to society, to your nation, to anybody. It's all a monopoly game. So I may be a good wife or a good husband or a good father because that's my service to Krishna, but not because of material dharma. And it may look the same. Here's a good husband, here's a good husband. Here's a good mother, here's a good mother. It may look exactly the same from the outside, but the consciousness is completely different. One person is thinking, oh, my husband has to be happy with me. If my husband's not happy with me, my life is falling apart. And the other person is thinking, Krishna has to be happy with me. My husband will be happy with me on Monday, maybe Monday night he will not be happy. Maybe Tuesday he will not be happy with me. Maybe he will love my dukkha on Wednesday, and on Thursday he will not love the same dukkha. Right. But I'm trying to please Krishna. Is that clear? Okay. I hadn't actually expected it. Okay, did anyone have any questions on chapter 8? Any of your challenge questions on chapter 8? Or anything else anybody wants to discuss on chapter 8?
Sincerity of purpose and conflict.
Okay. You want to know what is sincerity of purpose? I understand sincerity of purpose. Okay, what does sincerity mean altogether? So let's think about, in this class, how do you know who's a sincere student in this class? What do you have to do to be a sincere student?
Giving priority to
each aspect. Okay, so... How specifically would you give priority?
On coming.
So first of all, you have to show up. You have to be here. Like we have some people, they're never here. So if you're never here, you're not a sincere student. I mean, unless you're in the hospital or something. So first thing to be a sincere student, you have to just show up. That's the first thing. I think they say like 9/10 of accomplishment is just showing up. First, you have to show up, and best to show up on time. You know, if you show up at 1:15, here I am, so that's not. Since, well, how else do we judge sincerity?
Motivations.
Well, let's look at external. How else do you judge sincerity? How do you know who's a sincere student in this class? Yes. Do you participate? Or do you just, you know, have some iPad out and you're playing, what do they play? Angry Birds. You know, are you just playing some game on your devices or are you participating? Are you here? I've been in meetings, don't ask me which ones, where one third of the members are sleeping. Actually sleeping, like this. Actually, I'm not exaggerating. And I was supposed to make a presentation, and I go to the meeting, and I'm supposed to make my presentation, and one third of the people were really were like that. So, sincerity also means participation. And what else does sincerity mean? How else would you do it, sincerity?
To respect.
How would you demonstrate?
Something like, if I come to the class, I don't sleep, and I listen carefully.
Okay, you're listening carefully. Some other measures, yeah. That you try to apply what you're learning, that it's not just notes in a notebook, that you're actually trying to use it. How else would we measure sincerity?
Purpose of doing the task. What purpose, because of what purpose are you doing the task?
That's hard to ascertain, though. It really is. It's very easy to fool yourself as to what your purpose is. So that's a little tricky. And that's hard to ascertain in somebody else also. I mean, if you ask me what are the motives of each of you, I actually don't know. If you ask me what's my motives for doing this, I'm not sure that I can really be honest with myself. What are my motives? I know what I think my motives are. I can list what I think my motives are. Are they my real motives? I've seen enough people fool themselves about motives, and I've seen me fool myself about motives. We have a cheating propensity, right? That's not just somebody out there. It's me. I have a cheating propensity. That means I'll have a tendency to cheat others as to what my motives are and to cheat myself. I may say, I'm doing this just because I really care about Bhagavatam. Maybe that's not the only reason I'm doing it. Other thoughts? Yes?
What does it mean, perfect and complete
hearing? Perfect and complete hearing. Okay, let's finish this and then let's go to anybody else about sincerity? Yes?
Prior to the class, we read up the notes.
Okay, you do some preparation. So that also answers your question. You know, how am I sincere that I make sure that I'm in a state where I'm going to get the most out of what I'm doing? So that's I do some preparation. I do my homework. My daughter teaches dance and she always has a problem that some of her students don't practice. So that's how we judge sincerity in anything. I mean, Krishna has a very similar idea. First of all, you have to show up. You have to actually chant your rounds and come to the programs, and you have to be there, at least with the body. Two of my god brothers were talking about this is real. And one said to the other, well, you know, my heart's at Mangalartik, and the other said, why don't you bring the rest of your body? So, you know, first you have to show up. And then when you show up, to be attentive, you know, asking perfect hearing, to be attentive, to really be making an effort. And then to actually make an effort to apply. And to prepare yourself before coming so that you're more likely to be in a state. Perfect hearing, Prabhupada also says, is purity of mind and purity of action. To be in a state where I'm likely to benefit. If I come tired, if I come disturbed, if I don't even have any idea what the material is, then I'm not likely to benefit. So I see all these ways of sincerity and purpose. And as far as motivation, one should pray to Krishna to reveal one's motivation and be willing to make some changes when he shows what needs to be changed. Perfect hearing I see ultimately as total realization. So perfect hearing, yes, perfect hearing. That as soon as I hear something, it actually manifests in my heart and I experience it. That would be perfect. I'm sure we all have some of that sometimes. But sometimes we read something and we hear something and we go, oh. And it's there for us. It's not just an idea. It's a reality. But perfect hearing would be, you know, like Maharaj, like Sukadeva Goswami's talking about Krishna's leelas, and he's actually in the leelas when he's talking about them. Sometimes the verbs are in the present tense because as he's speaking the leelas, they're manifesting. So that would be perfect hearing. I mean, to some extent, all of us experience that. We read something in the purport and it's real for us. It's as if something opens in our heart, right? You all have this experience also. Something opens in your heart. You go, wow! And you see it. Pandita sama darshina. Right? Or tattva darshina. The guru is one who's seen the truth. So we're all supposed to be tattva darshina. We're all supposed to see a prachaksha bhagavan dharma. We're all supposed to be prachaksha, experience it. So perfect hearing is when you hear something and that hearing equals experience. It's not just something in the intellectual platform or the mental platform. But that doesn't happen until you're perfectly receptive, till you're perfectly pure. And the process of hearing, even imperfectly, purifies us, like everything else. You know, our imperfect hearing is cleansing us. Srinvitam swakata krishna punyashravanikirtana vidyantasta bhavani vijanoti suvitsada. It purifies us so that gradually our hearing becomes more and more perfect. Gradually and progressively. It's not like I'm just nonsense and then one day move from pure devotee. Of course, there is a one day, just like one day you get your diploma. So there is a one moment. You know, there's a moment of birth that you can put on the astrological chart. But that moment of birth is preceded by so many other things. It's preceded by labor, it's preceded by pregnancy, it's preceded by conception, it's preceded hopefully by marriage. You follow? Although you can say, oh, now at this moment the child is born. So there is a moment at which, oh, now there is Krishna, now there's perfect hearing. But that's preceded by, Prabhupada often gives this analogy that the woman doesn't get married and say, okay, where's my baby? Of course, in modern society, a lot of the women never ask for the baby. But anyway, it's not like that, but there's a process. Of course, even after the baby's born, that's not the end, that's also the beginning. So when perfect hearing takes place, that's the beginning of our rasa with Krishna and our eternal relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. But there is a dividing line by which you say, okay, you cross this line. Or like a journey, you fly to Delhi. I flew to Delhi from Calcutta. So, you know, there's a point at which you get off the plane and you're in Delhi. But there's steps. Is that okay? Yes.
Yesterday we were talking about being Krishna conscious now.
Yes.
So I don't know, it's very easy to put externals in place, but how do you really do a change in the heart?
That change in the heart is not very hard to do. That's one reason I said you could do it now. It's actually something quite easy. And anybody can do it, and anybody can do it now. Just simply imagine, because it's true, it's not your imagination, that Krishna is right here with you right now, seeing, hearing, and feeling what you're doing, because that's true. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. When you imagine it, it's not that you're creating it by your imagination. It's already true. But you can make a picture in your mind that there's Krishna. He's sitting right here on my little table. And he's looking at me. And he's smiling. Is he actually there?
Yes.
Whether I imagine him there or not imagine him there, is he there?
Yes.
Yeah. Why not think about him being there? Is that hard? Is that hard? No, it's not hard. Don't be afraid to imagine it. It's already real. You're not making it up.
It is hard if somebody is showing your head.
Huh?
It is hard until somebody is showing us that he's here.
No. Just imagine it. You don't have to wait till you're so. This is beginning Krishna consciousness. This is elementary. This is not advanced stuff. It's very elementary. Krishna's here. He's already here. Everybody agree? Okay, is he already watching what you're doing?
Yes.
Is he hearing what you're doing? Okay. Do you think Krishna's happy with what you're doing? Yeah. See that? That's all. It's that simple. And if you're working for something that has some result, see him being happy with the result, even if it's not here now. So you're in the kitchen making chapatis and cooking the rice. Just imagine Krishna's standing there in the kitchen, or maybe he's sitting on a nice chair in your kitchen, and he's watching your cooking, and he's happy. Now, you can meditate on him eating the rotis. You know, if you have deities in your house, you can think, my deities are watching me. Are they watching you? Yes. Are they hearing you? Yes. Are they smiling? Yes. Have I never seen a frowning deity? They're smiling. And you can think, you know, they're happy that I'm cooking, and they'll be happy when I make the offering, they'll be happy. And if you die in the middle of cooking, they're still happy. If your gas runs out in the middle of cooking, they've been happy the whole time. Is that right? If you get an emergency phone call and you have to leave your cooking in the middle, like the gopis left their cooking in the middle, Krishna called his food, and they left. They never finished their cooking, but Krishna was still cooking. So whether I finish the cooking or not, I can meditate on Krishna. Oh, you know, my goni taidis, they'll, I don't know where time is, but you know, my goni taidis, they'll be eating the chapatis, and they'll be so happy. But they're also happy watching me. That's all, it's all it is. That simple. It's that simple. It's not complicated. Krishna's here. He's watching, and he's happy. And he's happy with what I'm doing now. You could say, well, maybe he's not happy with what I'm doing now. Then try to have Krishna be happy with what you're doing now. Well, right now, I'm just awful. Krishna can be happy with me later. No, then. How can I make Krishna happy? And that's by sincerity of purpose. I make Krishna happy now because I'm trying to offer this thing to Krishna. I may be so full of so many faults and whatever, but at least I showed up. That's something. Is that okay? It's very, 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 very simple. We just have to practice it. And as you practice, because it's real, because it's not imagination, because it's real. As you practice it, it will become more and more and more second nature to you. And maybe when you start practicing it, you'll only remember to do it for 1 minute a day. And celebrate that. That day, say, wow, it was 1 minute today that I meditated how Krishna was right there smiling at me. And he was happy with me at this moment. And I was offering this moment to Krishna. Maybe one day you won't do it at all, and then another day you'll do it for 5 minutes. Celebrate that. Wow, I was actually conscious of Krishna for 5 minutes today. How lovely. And gradually it becomes easier and easier and easier and easier because it's real. I'm offering now to Krishna. He's happy now that I'm sitting in Vrindavan now and we're talking about Yudhisthira and Bhishma and Prabhupada's purport. And he's thrilled. If I only live another 5 minutes and I never take the exam, it doesn't matter. If I die in 5 minutes or have a stroke or a heart attack and I never teach this afternoon's class and all my preparation just sits here, look, he's still happy. He was happy when I was preparing. Whether I use it or not, then when I'm using it, he'll be happy. But his happiness when I was preparing it are not dependent on my using it. It's every moment. When I'm preparing it, he's happy. When I'm using it, he's happy. Sometimes. That's nice. One devotee said to Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya. Sometimes you fall into Krishna. So if only sometimes you forget Krishna. Very nice. For most of us, sometimes we remember Krishna. You just keep practicing. We were saying this the other day. Just like if you're going to learn to be a dancer. How do you learn to be a dancer? You practice, but this is natural. Thinking of Krishna is natural. Most of what prevents us from thinking of Krishna is our guilt, like I talked about the other day. We actually avoid thinking of Krishna because I'm thinking, well, I don't want to imagine Krishna sitting there because he won't like what I'm doing. No, imagine him anyway because he is there. And even if he doesn't like what you're doing, he still loves you, so he's still happy with you on one level. Still love your children. So you have children, you always love your children, even if they're not perfect, because they're never perfect. But you know, just the way it is. Yes?
Whatever realization and experience they are not.
Oh, don't worry about it. Please don't worry about it. Don't think with this. Well, I don't want you to be thinking, oh, I'm just a kanista, so I can't think about Krishna smiling yet. Please don't think that. That's Maya. Prabhupada, who did Prabhupada say could think about Krishna? That the alcoholic drinking his wine. So are you that fallen? So Prabhupada said Prabhupada said that in the chapter, in his lectures on chapter 8. So Prabhupada said, if the alcoholic drinking his wine thinks this wine is a taste of Krishna, someday he'll become a saintly person. Are you above that? Yes. Right? Yes. You're not drinking wine, right? If you were, you wouldn't tell us here. But anyway, we're going to assume you're not drinking wine. So if the wine drinker can remember Krishna, why can't you? You have to wait till you're a Madhuma or a Madhuma. First I'll become Krishna conscious, then I'll think about Krishna. Think about that for a little bit. How ridiculous that is. I can't think about Krishna because I'm not Krishna conscious enough. Sometimes it'll be so nice. You'll want to do it more. It's so much fun. It is. It's fun. Just think, there's Krishna. There he is, sitting right on my table, looking at me and laughing at such a fool I am. Aha, look at that Arula, thinking she can speak on the Bhagavatam. At least I'm making him laugh. Does that make sense to him? So sweet, because Krishna is our best friend. He's actually there. And someday, if you keep doing that, you'll see him. Like that Brahmana who meditated on serving Krishna, and one day Krishna says, okay. Some big realization for this. Just simple theoretical, logical realization. Krishna's already there. He already sees. He already hears. Let me just think about that. And that I'm offering right now, I'm offering to you. Otherwise, the other mentality is I'm working. When I get to this point, then I offer it to Krishna. Am I correct? Now, when you get to that point and offer it to Krishna, maybe you're not even thinking about Krishna. Maybe you're thinking about you. I did this, I offered it. And then maybe you're thinking about what everybody else is noticing. And maybe when you offer it to Krishna, it's not even so nice, or it doesn't work, or it breaks, or something. And then you devastate it. Correct? So that's a fruit of mentality. Krishna's service, okay, that's something. But it's still a fruit of mentality. It's not where we want to go. Okay, we can have one more on chapter 8 and then we need a break. Anybody else have a question on chapter 8? Yes.
It says that Vishnu Deva, you just said, during the first meetings of the pains.
This is from 8?
Yeah.
Are you jumping? Is it in 8? I can't remember. I've been preparing for so many at once that I can no longer remember where is what. Is it in 8?
It's in 1847.
It is 47. It is? I don't see it.
It's in the end.
1847.
He was maintained at the expense of Duryodhana.
You should read it. Does anyone else see it in 1847?
No.
I don't think so. I think you're in the next chapter. Which is fine, we'll be there in a minute. I don't see it in 1947. It's in 46? Oh, okay, okay. Yes, oh, all right. So we have here that I was talking about Karna. So what's your question about this?
Well, I don't understand why he takes the side of Duryodhana.
Well, Bhishma was doing the same thing that Karna did. He was choosing a lower principle over a higher principle. Except in Bhishma's case, he was doing that for several other reasons. Karna was doing it out of illusion. Bhishma was doing it because he has a chivalrous rasa with Krishna, and he wanted to fight with Krishna, and he wanted to fight with Krishna face to face. He didn't want Krishna, like it says that Bhishma could see Krishna fighting, and Arjuna just saw the back of Krishna, and Bhishma could see the front of Krishna. So one reason he did this is to facilitate his rasa with Krishna. Another reason he did it is because Krishna wanted to show that even someone like Bhishma who fights on the wrong side will lose. So the devotees being very open, we'll discuss this very soon, the devotees being very open to whatever Krishna wants them to do, they're happy even for Krishna to make a fool out of them, if that will facilitate his purpose. We did a drama at the Govardhan retreat, and I was playing a character that everybody laughs at. So it was quite interesting. So one of the characters everybody laughed with, but I was playing a character everybody laughed at. And I'll tell you that that's not so easy to do that. But if Krishna wants you to play a character that everybody laughs at, then you do that for Krishna. Somebody has to play that character. So, like Yudhisthira gambled away his life. So what's the lesson? That even if you're Dharmaraj, that gambling will bewilder you. You can't say, well, I'm so advanced I can gamble without being bewildered. Then everybody will say, what about Yudhisthira? Who's more advanced than Yudhisthira, and yet he became bewildered? So if you say, well, I'm so strong that even if I'm fighting for the wrong side, I can win due to my own strength. What about Bhishma? He was the most strong and he was the most military expert, but because he fought for the wrong side, he was defeated. So Krishna wanted to show that example. So Bhishma is willing to take that role.
He also says, no one excelled in knowledge.
Obviously, that's not an absolutely true statement. That's a statement of love. That Krishna likes his devotees to appear more knowledgeable than he is. Obviously, Bhishma did not. That's a loving statement. That's Prabhupada's love for Bhishma. That's all. That's speaking there. It's just like if a woman says, "My husband is the most handsome man on the planet," or the mother says, "You know, my child is this. Isn't he just the cutest child you've ever seen?" Prabhupada's ecstasy and his love also come. But superficially, Bhishma made a mistake in that he chose a lower dharma over a higher dharma. He chose, it was just like Karna. He said, I have a debt. Duryodhana's been feeding me and maintaining me, therefore I have a debt and I'm obligated to fight for him. And the lesson there is that's a mistake. Don't do that. Do the right thing, even if it means giving up the lower duty. Like the gopis, they give up their lower duty to do a higher duty. Or Vasudev, he promised Kamsa, and he gave up that truthfulness in order to follow Krishna's instructions, take me across the Yamuna. So don't put a lower duty over a higher duty. That even if you're Bhishma, if you do that, you'll be vanquished. But he wasn't really vanquished, because he got to fight with Krishna, and Krishna's there when he left his body. I mean, he was vanquished. Duryodhana was vanquished, but Bhishma wasn't actually vanquished. But they may do that, they have that role in the play. Krishna, I'm willing to take whatever role you give me in the drama. I don't have to be the lead part. And I don't even have to play the good guy. I'll do whatever service you want me to do. Obviously we shouldn't imitate that and say, well, I'm going to be a bad guy for Krishna. But if you're on that level, then that may be it. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll go on to chapter 9.